My name is Mireille Lapointe. My community is Ardoc Algonquin First Nation, and I'm here as a result of the Defenders of the Land Week rally in May of 2008, where at the end of this week, of that week, on the 28th of May, Bob Lovelace was released from prison. And I think it was called the Protectors of the Land at the time, morphed into this gathering, now called the Defenders of the Land. It was as a consequence of that. And because it was identified that we as First Nations have, we're facing common difficulties in our communities, brought from the outside by corporations and government, federal as well as provincial, sometimes municipal, and the understanding that we have among us is that we're facing these common difficulties that are turning into common tragedies in our communities. And these incursions are all based on the land. And so we felt that we needed to gather to discuss this and to come to a pointed decision on common action. Because through unity, we would be stronger. So I guess that's my perspective on this.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the main struggles and issues that your community is facing? You've already alluded to the Protectors of the Land gathering in May, and that was a result of struggles in the Ardoc area. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit more about those main struggles and issues that your community is facing?
In 2007, our community became aware that there was a uranium exploration company, a ventures company, that had staked over 33,000 acres of land in North, Central, and South Frontenac, and that they were looking for uranium. And then a settler approached the community, and then we investigated it, and we found that, in fact, they were on our territory. And because we had no idea. Permits had been issued. Mining leases had been issued. And we didn't know. So we pursued it. And there was no cooperation on the part of the province. And so we started a blockade at Robertsville. And the blockade lasted from June 28th, 2007, to right through into the fall. And through this, we were in court. Two injunctions were issued. We defied the injunctions. And the chiefs, at the time I wasn't co-chief, decided that their names would stand on the injunction so as to protect community members. So that Bob Lovelace's name, Paula Sherman, Harold Perry, and Randy Coda. Randy's name was not on there, I think. Anyways, and through this, we went to court, and we lost, basically. And it was Judge Cunningham who we've been told is the judge that advised Brian Mulrooney on bringing the army in at Oka. And this guy was, the settlers were talking to us about this. We knew, we felt it, but the settlers noticed it and came and talked to us how arrogant and almost racist Judge Cunningham's attitude was. There was even a settler who decided to procure herself with the court transcripts, and she has written a letter about this. She spent a lot of time doing her research. It flabbergasted me. I couldn't. It was palpable in the room, and very dismissive. Bob had a testimony that lasted almost a day, and he was reading papers, fidgeting, being totally dismissive in his attitude while Bob was speaking. I found him profoundly disrespectful, and I knew from his attitude that we were going to lose big time. But when he announced the six-month prison sentence on Bob, nobody could believe it. Even the police officers were stricken, like you could tell from their face. There was a police officer that was weeping. People were sobbing in the courtroom. It was pretty awful. And then, well, Bob went to prison. Paula took an undertaking. Harold had to, because he's too old. He can't go to jail. Eventually, Bob ended up spending 3 months in jail. And throughout all this, I have to say that KI, Big Trout Lake, Kitchinu-Minguzib, were our solid allies. And they were quite, they're an amazing community. And we stayed in touch with them. And then Bob was released on the 28th of May. And he had to pick up the parts of his life. During the summer we were recuperating, but it was also a very busy summer because we were making more connections. We were also having, I was doing small actions at Robertsville because it was very important. See, we were told by the injunction that we had to be 200 meters from the gate, which was the OPP's interpretation, which in fact was not so. It was 200 meters from Frontenac Ventures employees. So I was doing small actions at the gate and going straight to the gate and doing those. Bob did a few actions at the gate also. And throughout all this, there were letters exchanged between the government and us. But it's always the same thing. The bureaucrats are paid to keep the whole thing going in with paper and words, and that's their job basically. And it's like water, you know. It tries to wear you down, and it tries to sap your energy and sap your time. And they're paid to do that, and we're not. And, you know, we have full-time jobs to keep ourselves going, and we're doing this, but that's their full-time job. And it just, it's just all wrong. It's just wrong. And so now we're at the point where the government is ignoring us. We have made overtures to the government. We've told them we're ready to negotiate with them whenever they are ready to negotiate in good faith. We're still holding on. We've never deviated from our original point of view, which was no exploration or mining. And that's where we sit now. So we're doing community work, which we've always done. But we're concentrating on our community, so building community and doing all those things that we need to do to keep our community together. And by community, I mean the RDoC community, but I'm also talking about the allies, because we have two names. We have RDoC Algonquin First Nation, AAFN, but we also go under AFNA, AAFNA, which is RDoC Algonquin First Nation and Allies. And so to build this network of allies and keep it strong, so we have film once a week, once a month, we play a documentary and we discuss it together to come to a greater understanding of the community at large, but for the community at large to understand us and what it means to be a First Nation person, an Anishinaabe person in this country. And because the education system has been co-opted for this whole agenda. And that's, there's nothing taught about us in the education system. And I bring stuff to my classroom all the time. But, and the students are actually very grateful and they want to know more. But the system has co-opted all that. And there's nothing being taught so that we are ignored, not just by the government, we are ignored by the education system, which is a very powerful tool of colonization. And those are the things, that's one of the main thing for me as an educator that I work on, is in the schools, in the school board, and to do what I can to change that in my own way. You work where you are. So.
Just one more question. I know they're starting, but it's an important one. You shared over the last 2 days, especially on the first day when we started going across the country, you shared your struggle in Ardoch with uranium mining, how your community was under attack, the disrespect by the AFN, for example, and what have you. But you also listened to other people share their stories of defending the land and their struggles. And I'm wondering if you could reflect and share your thoughts about how it feels to hear about those other struggles and how that relates to your struggle.
Makes me sick. The worst thing was... The worst thing is to come to the understanding that it's a concerted effort on the part of the colonial government on all fronts to annihilate Indigenous people. And, you know, when people like me talk like that, we're looked on as radicals, but I'm not even saying it in a radical way. This is a fact. And all you need to do is to look at what's going on, and it is a fact. They came for our land in 1492, and they tried to get rid of us in many ways, and we're still here. They came for our kids and tried to get rid of us that way, and we're still here. And they're coming for the land again in many, many ways. I mean, leases in the water with grow lights in the water and killing fish so that, you know, just cleaning it out so you can do something else. By cleaning it out, I mean just destroying everything. And now they're coming at us again to get women and to get the kids again. And we have become commodities. We've become commodities not just in stores where everything Indian is commodified, but our plants and people now. And, you know, when you say that, when people call out that the women are being killed, it's not a joke. This is a fact. These are all facts that are verifiable. And so if that's not ethnocide, and if it isn't genocide, then what do you call that? And how could it not make me sick? How could it not make you sick? How could it not make everybody sick? In 1992... I don't believe in coincidences. And when Jack and I were in university, we bought a farm. We had to, I wanted land. I kept saying to Jack, we need a land base. And so we had nothing. And both of us had three jobs. But we paid for this land. And the farmer took back the mortgage, $260 a month. So we paid that and paid that and paid that. And we used to go every weekend and spend all our time on that place. And we sold 10 acres in 1992. And so there was a little chunk of change in the bank. And I went to listen to an elder. And this elder was talking about the land. And there was... there was a week or two, a week and a half being offered out west at the University of Lethbridge on reconnecting with who you are as an Aboriginal person. So I took my son, Joe, and we went together. And I went to a sweat lodge. And this was a 4-round traditional sweat lodge. And when I went in, I was sitting there thinking, trying to pray and thinking, what am I doing here? Why am I here? And I didn't realize it, but I was asking exactly the question you're supposed to ask for of yourself in a sweat lodge. You're supposed to go with a purpose. And I was doing exactly what I was supposed to do. But I was supposed to do it before I went in there. So I left after the first round, and I sat down beside this little old lady, and we each smoked a cigarette. And then I went back for the third round. And when I went in, it was like there was a hand that was pushing on the back of my head. And everybody disappeared in there. I was alone. And it was like I was with all the female souls that have ever been and ever will be. They were all there with me. And I felt this most profound sadness, not anger, sadness in my bones, in my cells, sadness. And then I felt this incredible love. And that it's the only way to say it. And it was like the love of a mother when, like my mother, I knew would never judge me. I could do anything and my mother would never judge me, ever. And it was that same kind of love. And I walked out of there feeling like I was 10 years old in the springtime, and I could smell all the smells and see all there was to see. And I realized later that I think it was that's what it is to be the earth. And what I did after that was I brought two Native Studies courses to my school, and that's where I started to just do what I could do. And this is what keeps me going, because no matter what we do to the earth will always be here. It will always be here. It doesn't need us. And what I'm doing is not for the earth so much as for human beings, because we're not always going to be here. And I look at my grandchildren, and I love who I am, and I love them. And that's why I do it.